This podcast is about two longtime friends from college, Dave Linhart and Paul Benovich, that reconnected 5 years ago and found that we both had a passion and a love for entrepreneurship and innovation. For the past 5 years, we have engaged in lengthy and frequent discussions about our life as entrepreneurs. It has been 25 years since we spoke prior to reconnecting, and quickly discovered that we had both taken a very similar path of entrepreneurship during that time. Through our many conversations over the past 5 years, we decided that entrepreneurship is a calling, and a very tough calling. It is not a life one would recommend to others, but more of a gravitational pull that you can't ignore, even when you try. This is a podcast about entrepreneurship. This is all I can tell you at this time. The theme within the theme will eventually be found. We are starting with the first episode and then figuring it out from there. Come join us on our journey. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, Paul.
Excellent. So Dave, this is our first episode, and I think for both of us, it's probably the first time that we've ever produced a podcast. Is that right?
Yeah, this is the first time. We had a lot of conversations before, but never really recorded them and made them available to anybody.
Excellent. So I guess I'm going to pose this question to you. As complete amateurs in this. So what do you think we're trying to do on this podcast? What is the theme that we're trying to cover on this podcast?
Well, you know, I mean, I know we share a passion for startups, for creating new startup businesses. And there's just a lot of interesting things that happen on that journey to go from an idea into hopefully a successful business. And so I think what we're trying to do is just share some insight with people on what we've observed in that process, what we've learned, in the hope that it'll be helpful to people. And I think the people that might benefit are ones who maybe have never done a startup before and they're wondering what it's really like to do it. Or maybe they're working on startups and have done a lot of startups and just would be helpful to know that other people struggle with some of the same challenges and can have some solutions to make that easier. Or just kind of the feeling to know that that there's a community of people that are out there trying to do the same thing.
So yeah, I agree. Yep.
I think for me, like, it's helpful to me when I talk about startup issues with you, because I usually get a lot out of it. Like I'll make some observations that I hadn't really thought about before, just in the process of talking with you, you know, almost like startup talk therapy or something. So
exactly.
Yeah. So I get a lot out of it too.
Well, no, it was great when we reconnected, you know, 5 years ago, and then we kind of shared our experiences. It was amazing for me to kind of really discover that other people were having these same problems as I was having. It was very therapeutic. In fact, I almost felt relieved.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah. And so in my opinion, it's so interesting. You know, if we're going back to what are we trying to do here and what's the theme? I know one thing. I know the overall theme, and that's to talk about entrepreneurship, in some way. And I think the theme within the theme will be discovered kind of naturally as we go along. And I find sometimes it's better for me to just focus on one thing. I'm just trying to create our first episode on a podcast. I've never done it before, and see if we have a passion for it. If we flow really well, and see if I like it. I think that's my personal goal with this first episode.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think if we're enjoying it and can kind of find a flow in it, I think it'd be really rewarding. I mean, the other thought that just popped into my head is part of the value here might just be storytelling. Like when I think when I talk about my background relative to, you know, people have chosen another path, like more of an employee corporate path. what I've heard from my friends is that my stories are just more interesting, you know, because like, and not, you know, it's not the, it's just the nature of like creating something from nothing is just a really interesting story. And not to say that there's less value in working at a company, there's not, but like, you know, there's this hero's journey kind of story of like very small team of people trying to create something out of nothing and all the obstacles that they come up against. It's just a really interesting story. So
it is, yeah, maybe that's true. Right. Absolutely. You're so right on there.
Yeah. It's just entertaining, hopefully.
Yeah. And sometimes very painfully entertaining, but that makes it even more entertaining.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a good story, right? Like a good story just isn't all, you know, sunshine and rainbows. A good story has got ups and downs and tragedy and, you know, devastation and like coming back from being knocked out on the mat. I mean, that's a much more interesting story.
I agree with you. And so I think we both agreed that, you know, we're kind of looking at this and attacking it the same way we might attack an idea that we want to bring to concept. And so the story will be written as we go along with this and as we move forward. And I think it will be a kind of an interesting journey. And I don't think we necessarily have to define what this is going to be all about in this first episode. But I think that we'll start to get our feet wet and see where it takes us.
Yeah. And, it's not the first time. Like we haven't done a podcast or anything, but in the when we're working on that Founder Sensei concept, we recorded some videos and I showed it to a few folks that were on my team, and the feedback I got was like, that was a really interesting discussion. Like if you guys had a podcast or something, I would listen to it, you know? So that there's a little bit of a seed of an idea there, at least for me, where it's like, you know what? We do have great conversations. You know, you and I like really get into it and it is really interesting. I mean, I love just listening to it myself, and I think other people will too, hopefully.
Excellent. And that kind of takes us into, you know, the title of this podcast, you know, and at least my proposed title for it is Getting Started. So you have an idea for a business, now what? And I think that it's so appropriate because this is where we're at right now. Like we came up with we said, hey, maybe we should do a podcast. Well, that's no different than this whole topic. So how do you get started on something like this? And so you have this, we had this idea for a podcast. Now what? Now what do we do? And I think a lot of people that are in, you know, venturing off into entrepreneurship or thinking about it, they're trying to tackle the same problem.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. And there, you know, there's an infinite number of ways to approach it, and there's a lot of people that will give you different advice. You know, so in terms of like getting started, I mean, some people take an approach of like, well, I need a plan. You know, I've got an idea, but I need a business plan, or I need to do a bunch of research and see, you know, what's out there competitively, and I just need to put a plan together. I think that was maybe historically how people went about creating startups. And I think, you know, just in my recent experience in the corporate market, it's still true today. Like when you are working in a corporate environment, you want to get resources. You can't get resources unless you have a plan. So kind of the first step that a lot of people take, and I'm not saying it's the best way, is to put a plan together. You know, in my experience, though, that's not the best way to do it. The best way to do it is just do something. Like, honestly, like what we're doing here is a good example. Like, we don't really have a plan for what this podcast is.
Right.
It's just like, let's just do something and see how it goes. This is a creative process. Like, we are co-creating this thing together, you know, you and me. And so I don't really know where it's going. I just think I'm getting, you know, if it sounds like it's fun, it sounds like it'd be valuable, you know, let's try it. Let's see where it goes. Let's show it to some other people and see what comes out of it organically. And I've just learned that tends to work better for me than a lot of planning up front.
I agree with you as well. I mean, my motto is I'm a builder. So let's just start building. So yeah. Let me go into like next question. Let's give the audience a little bit of history of us, just so that they kind of understand our relationship. And so one of the first questions I have for you, and I'm going to pose to you, is how did we originally meet?
Yeah, so I was thinking about that recently. So, you know, I was a pledge at a fraternity at Purdue University. You were attending Purdue University as well. You were a couple years older than me, I think 2 years older than me.
I think I'm 3 years old. Yeah, I just spent a little bit more time in college, so it seemed like I was less.
Yeah, you may have been a senior when I was a freshman, right? So
No. I think I was a junior.
Oh, you're a junior. Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I started pledging and, you know, so that was all cool. But what I remember is I think I'd met you in passing a couple of times, but I didn't really know who you were. But there was a barbecue. We had a mutual friend. I don't remember her name. Her name was Christine something or Christina.
Oh, Christina York. Remember?
Yeah. That's her.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, she had a barbecue at her parents' house, and she lived at Owen Hall. Okay, right up on the other side. There was like a co-ed dorm at Purdue at the time. They'd be like girls on one side and guys on the other. And I was dating her roommate, and so she, you know, invited me to this barbecue.
Oh my God, I remember now. Okay, that's okay, really remember, funny. Yeah, so, and now I completely remember who she was. Blonde, right?
The girl I was dating, or
I think it was right.
No, she was brunette.
Brunette, okay.
All right. Anyway, so you were there, and you know, I just remember being struck by you. It's like you're just this big, gregarious guy. You were like really happy and upbeat. You were just like happy to be at the barbecue and. I don't know. He had such a great personality. It was just like pure happiness and joy. And, you know, you're in the fraternity that I was pledging. And I was like, this guy's a pretty cool guy. I'm glad I met him. And I just didn't think much more of it than that. And then I think the following week, maybe Monday, Tuesday, we had some kind of pledge meeting. And the senior dean at the time was like, okay, you guys got to get big brother. So write down the name of somebody that you want to be big brother. And I thought of you and I was like, oh, this Paul guy's pretty cool. You know, and that's all I knew. So I put down your name. You're the only name I put down. I didn't really know anyone else in the house. Like I knew the guys that were in my class, just kind of getting to know them, but I was just still, you know, getting to be part of the fraternity and stuff.
That's it. And, interesting, because one of the things was I couldn't remember how we met. To be honest with you, I was like, how did we even met? And I guess the next question is, you know, before we reconnected, like when we were in school, I don't recall, we didn't really connect on a whole bunch of different levels. I mean, you were my little brother and I was your big brother, but while at school, we just didn't have that much in common during that time. And not in a negative way. It just didn't feel like we were very... We had a lot of connection at that time.
Well, here's what I think I knew that you didn't know, like at the time. There was some kind of subconscious or there was an energy there that we had in common that wasn't necessarily obvious. And I remember when I put your name down, who was our pledge trainer was Dave Ritz, I think. If I remember. Oh,
okay.
And he was like Paul Benevich. Like he was like, this is such an odd selection, because at the time I came to Purdue because I was studying engineering and I was really interested in the co-op program, you know, where I could work at a big company while I was going to school, like alternating semesters and work sessions. So I was very like corporate, you know, I had this corporate focus where I wanted to be, you know, CEO of a Fortune 500 company. So I was a pretty like straight-laced guy, like straight-A student, you know, just, you know, well-groomed.
you were the complete opposite of me. I mean, like if you put the two of us together, I would have never pictured you as an entrepreneur. And when I reconnected with you 25 years later, I was so surprised because the Dave that I had envisioned from college was not the Dave that was taking the same journey I was, because we were we're completely different personalities at that time.
In college. That's right. That's right. You were like, you know, wearing flip flops and hanging out in Colorado in the summer, like rafting and sleeping on a rock for 3 months. And, you know, that was your kind of vibe. And my vibe was like, you know, no, I'm, you know, like Alex P. Keaton or some shit. Right. Like I was, but I think what,
That was intimidating for me. I was like, this guy's way too smart for me. He wants to conquer the world, and I'm just trying to get by through the next semester.
Well, what's really interesting about it, though, is that really I'm not a corporate guy. Like, I know that now. I mean, going like 30 years later or 25 or however long it's been, like, I did the corporate thing, and I didn't fit in there. Like, I did the work, but in terms of cultural, functional hierarchy, bureaucracy, like that stuff is soul killing for me. I'm really more of a free spirit. I value freedom and creativity. So I think what I saw in you was like part of myself that was my true self that I hadn't quite figured out yet. But that's why I was kind of drawn to you, because you had this free spirited nature that I didn't even know that I possessed or wanted. I just, you know, it was just made you appealing.
Ah, see, you're so nice and kind. You make me feel like that was a great quality to have, which, you know, for many years I tried to run away from, because I thought it was just, I was like, oh, I got to get serious. I got to do corporate America, even though I don't want to. And I dread it. Right. Yeah. I was afraid to graduate. I mean, my last day of school, I remember sitting there with another friend of mine, my roommate, John Laughlin, and it had been 4.5 years of amazing college. I mean, it was like, and I knew that I was not equipped for the real world, not equipped at all. I mean, my personality, I was like, I was an amazing place with 30,000 other students. Who wouldn't love this? I had tons of people to talk to. I had friends. It was good. I was living in the present. And then I remember looking at John Laughlin, and both of us have a very similar personality. And it was like 11:30 on graduation day. And both of us were like, I can't get out of bed. This is like the worst day of my life. And I remember my sister had to come into my room, and she had to yell at both me and Laughlin because our parents were coming to see our graduation. She said, this is not about you. This is about them. So,
yeah. Well, there's something else about this story that I want to get in here, because it just occurred to me. Like, you, I don't know if you remember this, but you played a significant role in my integration, or I guess my participation in the house, in the fraternity, because the other thing people didn't realize about me at the time is that I'm a rebel. Like, I'm very rebellious, and I have massive problems with authority, which doesn't bode well for a corporate career. Right.
Right.
Exactly. So there was I joined, the pledge class, and you know, there was some, I guess hazing is the term. There's some hazing going on, right? And so some of the stuff, some of the guys were being dicks, and I didn't like it, right? And so we had to do books. Remember, we put together the...
Sure, yep.
And at the end of the book, we're supposed to like summarize what pledgeship means to us or something. And I don't remember what I said, but I basically told the whole house to go fuck itself.
Which is, when I know you now, is so appropriate, because that's right. You.
Right. And people were like, who the fuck is this guy? There was like people wanted me to be thrown out. Like, there was a lot of people that wanted me to throw out. And you, I remember you stepped up and defended me. And you were like, no, this guy, he's just front. I don't know what you said, but you defended me.
Oh, and that's great. I don't even remember that.
Yeah.
That's
fantastic. And I think because you did, I didn't get kicked out. Now, of course, we went into Hell Week and everything, and I was like targeted, right? Because I had put this big bullseye in my head. But the thing is, like, I knew all the material really well. So, you know, guys would come up to me and challenge me, and then I'd get the questions right, and they keep asking me questions. I kept getting them all right. And so they would just like leave in frustration. And, but anyway, that was a significant role that you played as like defender of the maverick rebel. And I think that was part of your energy too, that it somehow I knew was there. And I didn't even know that I needed that, but it turns out I did.
Well, and I'm going to put it in a plug for you just to give people a little bit more insight. So you went on and you graduated. And then, you know, I find out 25 years later that you then went on for your MBA at Harvard University. And that's just, I mean, again, just talks a little bit about the difference. I mean, there's no way I would ever made it into Harvard, not even close. But I think that, you know, when you said you just knew everything, like nobody was going to challenge you because, I mean, you're a very smart guy. I mean, that's one of the things that I really appreciate about you.
Thank you. I mean, I do have an intellect. I don't know how to respond to that except, you know, the Harvard thing was really interesting. I mean, I obviously realized at some point that I really enjoyed the business aspects. You know, I studied engineering and I, you know, loved technology and science, but then became really interested in the business side. So, you know, going to business school made sense. But yeah, I mean, I felt lucky to get in there for sure. I mean, I was just a kid from Michigan, gets accepted to Harvard. It's like, wow, that's a big deal. Nobody from my family had ever been to an Ivy League school or anything like that. So yeah, I felt lucky to do it. But it was interesting that I didn't know that I really fit in there either. Like this was kind of I don't know if we want to go down that rabbit hole, but there was just I think there's like the appearance that you put off maybe to other people, but then who you really are is this just a deeper, you know, kind of energy that will attract and repel certain things, and you don't even know why until years later, where it starts. Well,
so let me ask you this. So, because this kind of goes into my next question, you know, and the question is, in your opinion, how do you know you're an entrepreneur? But let me, before we get there, when you went to apply to Harvard and you went there, had you had any entrepreneurial ventures before that, or did it all happen after Harvard? And then the second question is, did Harvard help you realize that you wanted to be an entrepreneur? If you could just talk to both those.
Yeah. So I had entrepreneurial DNA, I think, when I was young. Like, so at 12, I had my, you know, a paper route, which was like my little business. And so I grew up in a, you know, family of five kids and, you know, kind of middle-class family. So like, I realized that my parents were teaching me to be self-reliant. And then if I wanted to, you know, have money to do things, I was going to have to figure that out on my own. Like they weren't going to be giving me much of an allowance or anything. So, but I just was, I wanted to build something for myself. And so, you know, I did the paper route thing at 12. I did that for a couple of years. And then at age, I think I was 14 and a half, I got a work permit to work as a janitor in a printing press. So like I had been working almost my whole life. And then in high school, I developed a painting company where I was painting homes, kind of as an independent contractor. I had a friend who was a real estate agent or a friend's mom was a real estate agent. And I started studying painting and like surface treatments. And I don't know, I was just interested in painting for some reason. And so she always, when she got a new listing, she would, I sold her as on my painting services. So when she got a new listing, I would come in and paint the whole house. I would paint the inside and the outside. And there weren't any employees or anything. It was just me. And it was a better source of income for me at the time than working, you know, at a fast food joint or something. So I had that kind of entrepreneurial, DNA or affinity right in the beginning. And then I think what happened is I got it beat out of me by the educational process. Like, sure. Yep. You know, my parents were not entrepreneurial and their advice was always, you know, study hard, get good grades and get a good job. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'll do that. And you know, the way education is set up, like they don't really encourage entrepreneurship at all. They're basically like training people to be employees.
Absolutely. And let me ask you this, when you applied, so what was is there a focus for your MBA at Harvard, or was it just a general corporate MBA, or was there an entrepreneurial component to it?
Well, at the time, and I don't know if this is still true, but Harvard doesn't allow you to specialize. So everybody gets a degree in general management. And and that's by design. They want to focus on general managers, leadership, people who are have multiple functional areas, but are more general managers. And so nobody has a specialty. But in my case, I knew I wanted to do something in technology, and I took every, you know, the first year was all required courses. The second year was all electives. And I took every tech course that they had. So I took like information technology courses and disruptive innovation courses. Like I knew I wanted to do something in tech, and I knew that I wanted to do something very entrepreneurial. But again, my thinking was really more in the corporate world. There was an entrepreneurial management course. I think one course, and it was very popular. Everybody took it to get a sense of what it was like to be an entrepreneur, but it didn't really give you a sense for what it was like to be an entrepreneur. There was no experiential component. It was just the case method, looking at different case studies. It was kind of like learning how to play golf by watching somebody play golf. It was it was cool for an awareness, but it didn't really teach me what it was like to be an entrepreneur.
Well, and that's such an interesting thing, because there are so many major entrepreneurial books and successes from people that came out of Harvard. So,
well, you know, and I have to say, like, in defense of my alma mater, I mean, they've changed things a lot. It is more experiential now. Like, I think everyone in the first year actually creates a business. So they've revamped the program a lot. But when I was there, it was still very just focused on the case method.
Yeah, I just listened to a podcast about Birchbox, and the founder there was a Harvard grad, and it was very interesting to hear her story as well.
That's cool. Their heritage is, you know, investment banking, consulting, corporate. That's kind of their heritage. And when the big startup wave came through, like .com one, it kind of took them a while to figure out that they need to change their program. And they did so successfully, is my understanding.
So Dave, let me go back to the question. If based on your experience and people that you've talked to over the years and stuff, in your opinion, how do you know if you're an entrepreneur?
Well, I think, you know, there's probably a lot of ways you could come to that. I mean, in my case, the light bulb kind of went off when I was working at AT&T Wireless. So I was working in a corporate environment, and I created this product that was really successful, that ended up adding a lot of money to, like, billions of dollars in value to AT&T. And so I felt like, okay, you know, this was my first job out of business school, and, you know, helped create a lot of value there. And I felt like I was doing pretty good. But then I had my performance review. It was like horrible.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I don't understand. So what I think almost every time this happens to me in a corporate environment is I'm always getting in trouble. Always. And what I get in trouble for, like, if you look at the business aspect of, you know, developing a product, like figuring out who your customer is, what the problem, you know, like all the business and product and entrepreneurial aspects, I was just crushing it on that front. But when it came to anything that was political or organizational, I was always pissing people off, always getting in trouble, always saying the wrong thing.
And so, I remember you telling me that it's like being sent to HR is like being sent to the principal.
I mean, I told you this joke about this job I had at Amazon, where I spent so much time in the HR department, I felt like I should move my desk there. Like, I was there, all the time. I was there all the time. And it was so funny. Like, I remember one time I sent an email to this HR person. She's like, I don't know if you know who I am. But she's like, oh, we know who you are.
Within the organization.
So, like, that was kind of a sign, you know? And so I went, like, my performance review at AT&T was like, you know, they always give you the good stuff first. And it was like, Dave, you know, you got great ideas and you've had a huge impact in the business, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, great. Thank you. And then they said, but you're totally insubordinate and nobody can manage you. And I would be like, yeah, okay, I'll admit to that. But, you know, but given what you said in the first part. Like, you guys are way ahead. So what's the problem? I literally would say that. Like, I didn't even understand that it was a problem.
Right, right.
Because I had no interest in, like, managing my boss. You know, there's, I think there's a book written called How to Manage Your Boss. Like, I just skipped that book.
Right.
Because to me, I had this mindset, I still have this mindset today, that it's like playing football. Business to me is like playing football. I grew up playing football. I was a quarterback. So I'm just trying to score points. I'm trying to score the points to win the game. And so in business, it's like the points are measured by your financial statements and all, you know, customer resonance, stuff like that. And so that's what I'm focused on. I don't really care. Like, I don't have an interest in putting energy in managing my boss. I don't. I'm out here playing, and it's like we're winning. We're scoring touchdowns. And sometimes my boss is like complaining about the plays that we're calling.
Right. Yep.
And I'm like,
that's such a good example.
Just leave me alone and let me win the fucking game. Like, so, and that's the attitude I brought to it as well. Like, if anyone would criticize me, I would kind of bring that attitude. Like, why are you focused on this? And then I realized that in a corporate world, my equation was just off. Like, there is tremendous value in being part of the culture and being part of the organization, and like all the political and social aspects of that are more important, I think, than the financial performance. And to me, it was like, wow, maybe I'm in the wrong place.
Sure. Right. I mean, you have to have a culture that kind of, I mean, when you deal with so many people and the organization gets pretty big, you have to have a common direction, and you can't have, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 people go in their own direction. It would be a
disaster.
Well,
that's the thing, right? I mean, it's all about alignment. If you go to corporations today, like, well, we have to get aligned on this. It's a very consensus driven model in a lot of places. And the fact is, like, innovation and really disruptive innovation is not a consensus building process. It's like when I'm doing a startup, I might have 10 guys in the room and 9 of them disagree with me, but I just know that it's going to work. So I'm doing it anyway. Like, I have to.
Right.
And if I can't convince you, well, that's unfortunate. I mean, I wish I could convince you, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to not do it. I have to do it.
Right.
And that doesn't work in a corporate environment. You know, so if your boss agrees with what you want to do, then great. But if he disagrees, then I got a major problem, because I have to do it. This is what people don't understand. It's like, I have to do it.
Yeah. And it's so, funny because I've been in corporate America a few times where I've gone back, and, you know, my job would be to say, hey, you know, they just want me to do what they've developed, their processes that they develop. And the problem I always run into is I'll do it for, you know, a couple months, and then I'll be like, well, what if we do it this way? And I start to be creative on it, and they're just like, no, we just want you to do exactly what the processes are set up to do. Just do it over and over and over again. And I find that I'm spending a lot of energy trying to recreate the processes. And I'm one of those people that if I'm not the one that created the processes, it's very difficult for me to follow somebody else's process. I have to understand how they got there. It's like looking at a math problem. And I would always say, well, okay, I get that there's a formula here. And they're just use the formula. I'm like, but how did you get to the formula? I can't use something that I have absolutely no idea how you got to. And that's the problem I run into constantly.
Yeah, so I would say that's, you know, for me, that was the first sign, is like, okay, I don't fit into the corporate culture and I'm getting in trouble. And I'm not trying to get in trouble. Like, believe me, I could get in a lot more trouble if I tried. But like, I'm not trying to get in trouble. I'm just being myself. And it just, trouble's coming. And so that was one thing. The other thing I would say is that what you just, so picking up on what you just said, like, if it's a big company, they're going to have a business model that's proven and that's profitable, most likely. And so a lot of what your job is executing that model and making it a little bit better. So there's kind of a machine that's running already. And so you just need to get with the program and make the machine run a little bit better. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And some people love to do that. If you're an entrepreneur, though, you're going to be kind of bored with that. That's going to sound like routine to you and kind of humdrum and tedious. What you really want, if you enjoy like creating an entirely new machine from scratch, that's a big indicator that you might be an entrepreneur.
And I think it goes for years. I mean, every single time that, you know, I've had a disappointment as an entrepreneur and said, hey, you know what, maybe I should go back to corporate America, because there is that gravitational pull. I mean, like society says you should have a consistent job that's not through going through these ups and downs. And you know, I feel bad for any spouse that's not an entrepreneur living with an entrepreneur, because it's pure hell for them. And I acknowledge that.
Yeah, you're right about society. I mean, it's really hard to live in America or Western society without regular income. It's really hard. The whole system is set up to force you to do that. And I think it's by design, actually. I think when you get people into this kind of hierarchical structure, it's much, you know, you're trying to control them. It's easier to control them. So yeah, I mean, that's the challenge, right? Like, you want to be creative and go off and do things, but that means there's not necessarily going to be income coming from it right away. There's an incubation period. And so it creates tremendous pressure, financially, personally, relationships. I mean, you know, I was married for a long time and no longer married. I mean, so I think it's just a really common problem that entrepreneurs have.
Well, and I'll just go through one example. I remember for one of my startups, I hired somebody out of a major. It was actually out of eBay, and he had a very prominent position there. And so I was all excited about bringing him in. And the one thing that I found, and this, I think it kind of goes to the story of whether you're an entrepreneur or not. He came in and he said, well, I'm going to do this for 3 months and see if we have funding, and we should have funding by then. And I looked at him, I was like, we're in a startup. There's no guarantees we're going to have funding. I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, no, we're going to get funding in 3 months. We've got to, because that's other than that, if we don't have it, I've got to go back to corporate America. And I was like, man, that was my first time that I was like, I think I hired the wrong person. And then the second thing that went on is there was a sense of, I'm like, okay, so he was a technology guy, but he said, why aren't you working like 10 hours a day? We are. He's like, well, I did my work in 5 hours. I said, well, this isn't an efficiency contest. When you do the work that you do you're a senior executive, then you start saying, how else can I help in the company? But I'm expecting that you're going to work 10 hours a day to get this thing started, but you're not going to see like, oh, I worked 5 hours and I'm done, and I'm just focused on my own little department. I like, we got to do fundraising. We've got to get the operations processes in place. We've got to, you know, look at marketing. We got to put marketing material together. These are things that an executive has to do across the board. You can't just be in your silo. So those were two things that I found, is that an entrepreneur, you can live on being poor. You will adjust your lifestyle accordingly so that you don't have your big expenses and everything. You'll shed everything so that you can be an entrepreneur.
Well, and I think, a lot of times it is true. I mean, hopefully, though, to me, what nirvana is when you create a business that starts making money, because then you have the best of both worlds. You have money coming in, and you're doing what you love. So it's kind of like getting through that.
Absolutely.
That process to the point where your business is working. And I think what you're saying is like, there's a pretty huge difference in mindset between an employee and an owner. And I think most corporations, of course, you know, they've got employees, they don't have owners. Even at a place like Amazon, where there's like huge stock compensation, I would still say that that's true. I think people, even with the stock incentive, people are generally acting like employees there.
Sure. Yeah. So let me go on to my next kind of question to you. Because I guess this is the thread of this entire episode here. And so, in your opinion, when somebody has an idea, you know, what would you recommend that person do to get it to the marketplace? How do you take that concept out of your head and try to realize it? What's your philosophy behind that?
Yeah. So what I do now, and I used to do the business plans and all these other things too, which were ultimately a total waste of time. I think what I do now is if I have an idea for something, that idea is usually rooted in a problem, and it's a problem that I've experienced firsthand. So the first thing I do is try to distill down what is the problem that I'm solving. You know, so an example would be, I'm working on this this in real life social service called Come With, and one of the problems is this, like, you know, making new friends. Like, if you have an existing social graph and that's pretty well saturated, but how do you make like a new friend, and particularly when you're like middle aged or out of school and stuff? So that's just an issue I've come across personally, and so I'm like, huh. So let me try a couple different services to solve that problem. You know, let me try Facebook. Let me try Meetup. Let me try all these things. And if I can solve that problem with something else, great. But normally if I can't find a way to solve that problem, I'm like, huh, why is it this way? Like, and then I start thinking like, who else might have this problem? So the first thing I do is try to have a conversation with somebody else about the problem. So I might think about, well, who's in my situation? Maybe a guy who, you know, is a middle-aged guy, divorced, single. Okay, let me go find a middle-aged, divorced, single guy to talk to about this. Right. And so I do. I reach out to somebody and I'm like, hey, man, I was just thinking about this. This is a problem I've experienced. What do you think? Like, do you have this problem? If you do, you know, how do you solve it? So I start getting those conversations going with basically anybody who will talk to me.
And I've been there, because I've been part of those conversations, and I'm usually one of your target
people. Right. Right.
So target audiences.
Yeah. Cause I realized, you know, having done so many startups, I realized that if you don't have a meaningful problem to solve for customers, you're not going to get anywhere.
Right.
And so that's kind of the first building block, is what is the problem that we're solving, and who has this problem, and how big of a deal is it? Like, is this a nice to have or a must have problem solved? So in this case, you know, I was at a bar, and this guy, Todd, who lives on the island here, like, I kept running into him. It's a small island. I live on Bainbridge Island. It's like a Seattle suburb. And I kept running into this guy, and he's going through a divorce right now. So I started talking to him about this social life. And I would say, hey, you know, here's a problem I've had. Have you faced this problem before? And he's like, yeah, you know what? That is a big problem. So anyway, you just talk to as many people as I can to try to get a sense for how widespread this thing is. Like, how many people have this problem? Who are the folks that tend to be the ones that are, you know, suffering the most from it? And that's the first time. And I have to say, I've never had a situation where that was a dead end. Never. There's like, I found that if I'm having the problem, there's definitely somebody else, you know, usually large groups of people.
Absolutely. And you find that oftentimes the problem may shift. What you thought was the problem, you may discover that it's an adjacent problem. You didn't nail it, but that's what you're going out to the marketplace. And let me ask you a few other questions. I mean, one of the things that I've found is that, you know, I always recommend you got to get it out of your head as soon as possible and start to build something, whether it's a prototype or something, because the longer it stays in your head, the more complicated it becomes. You start imagining how big this is going to be, and, you know, you start thinking about how you're going to be making money, and then you start strategizing on all these things, and you lose the basic concept, the simplicity of what it is, that original idea. It's almost like you wake up in the morning and there's so much clarity in the morning. And I think it getting that out when it's just a seedling of an idea and starting to bring it to light is the best way to do, because that's where you have the most clarity on it. The longer you keep it in your head, the bigger it becomes, and it gets so big, it's intimidating. And it's almost like deciding that, you know, that's your mind at 7 o'clock at night, when you've had all these competing agendas and life is so complicated, there's no simplicity anymore to it.
Yeah. So I think you're right. I think you're right. And I agree. I mean, to me, the problem and the solution are so integrated that, like, the problem is what creates the solution almost in a way. I mean, they're just so tightly integrated. So to your point, exactly right. Like, when I had this idea for Come With, this was, I've had this idea a long time ago. When I first moved to San Francisco, it was like 2015. This idea first came to me. And so what is that, 5 years ago? And so I sketched it out. I was like, okay, what does the app look like? And I just sketched it out. Like, this is what I want. I want this service that does this and has these features. And so you're right, like bringing that into the physical, I mean, it wasn't physical because it's a document, but what I mean is like, instead of having it in my head as this nebulous thing and trying to make it specific in terms of a design and a feature set really helps birth the idea, right? And then you have something you can look at. You're like, is this right? You know, does this work this way? This is what I would want. I find that's one of the easiest shortcuts is like build it for yourself. And then, yeah. You know, and then like start showing it to some people that resonate with the problem. Like, hey,
it becomes somewhat tangible, right? And I think that's you got to take it from this mind, from your mind, and you actually have to make it into something that's somewhat real in our reality. And I think that's where a lot of people kind of stumble. That's always my first recommendation. And I think the other thing that's really important is the process of actually putting something on paper and sketching something out and putting some type of prototype together to show somebody will also let you know whether this is a passion of yours or whether this was just an idea. And I think it's really important for you to understand whether you should, if you don't have a passion for what it is that you're doing, and it's just an idea that you don't really have a passion for, then you really want to get that out of your head so that you can start to focus on those things you have a little bit more passion for. Because there's a ton of great ideas I thought I loved, but as I started to sketch it out, I said, ooh, this is going to be a lot of work. And I don't necessarily know if I really want to be dedicating my time to this. And I kick it right out as soon as I possibly can.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a shortcut that I have come up with, which I'm still kind of playing with it. So I don't know if it's a good shortcut, but I think it is, where it's like, you can't be passionate for, like, if you think about a business is ultimately there to serve customers. Right. And so you might have an idea that comes out of your own needs. Like the way I approach it is like, I'm trying to solve this problem for myself. So that's at that point, it's not a business. It's just like a hobby basically. But when you get to the point where you realize, hey, a lot of people have this problem, can I build a business around this? When you get to that point, you are serving customers, you're serving people. And if you don't really care about them and have empathy for their situation, you're not going to have passion for the business. So I've done like B2B and B2C. And one of the things that I realized, you know, I've done a couple enterprise B2B companies, is I don't have a lot of passion for helping some big company become even more big and powerful. Like, you know, it's like, right, and having to wade through all the bureaucracy as a way to help them. Right. Like, so to me, that's demotivating. Right. Whereas like helping people connect with other people so they aren't lonely anymore or whatever, like that's a worthwhile endeavor. Like, to me, I have like a passion around that. So I think that's it. You have to have empathy for your customers. If you don't have empathy for your customers and you can't put yourself in their shoes, then it's going to be tough to build a business around it.
Oh, and I agree. I think that's an awesome thought process. So let me ask you this, Dave. So in your experience, you know, where do you see people stumble when they're trying to get an idea off the ground? What do you think the biggest stumbling points are, obstacles that entrepreneurs put in front of them that kind of sink their idea?
Well, I think there are two things that come to mind. The first mistake that I see a lot of people make is they spend, you know, $25,000, $30,000, $50,000 on an MVP before doing enough validation of the idea.
Oh, so, my God. Yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, I've done it in my early days. I did that a few times as well.
Yeah, and I have too. And that's kind of the only way you learn this lesson.
Absolutely. Because it's a stinger. It really is.
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks. Like, I built this website once called youbaby.com. It was like a social media site for, you know, expecting moms. And nobody signed up for it. Like, I couldn't pay people to use this thing. Like, that's how bad it was. But I spent like, I don't know, 40 grand developing this amazing social site that nobody cared about. And that was really my first time that I had done that. But yeah, that was a good lesson. So I think almost every entrepreneur has to go through that. It's almost like your MBA, the cost of your training is to build something for 25 to 50 grand that totally flops. And I tell, you know, people that I mentor, I tell them this story, like, do not do this. And they do it anyway.
Yeah.
Because, you know, words don't teach. There's certain things you can only learn through experience, and entrepreneurship is definitely one of them. And so after I lost the 30 grand or whatever it was, like, that got my attention, right? It was like, holy shit, what went wrong here? Like that.
Well, and what happens is this. I mean, you spend oodles of time on it, not even to say the amount of money and resources you spend on it. And you're the entire time you're scheming about what's important, what isn't important. You are like, you're in your mind, you're like, these are the features that are important to everyone. And then what you discover is you put this product out there, and within like, I don't know, a few days of putting it out there, you get so much feedback that tells you, oh, I missed the boat. It was these features that they really wanted, not these. And you could have actually done that in 2 weeks. You could have put a prototype out there and spent, you know, $200, and you could have gone out there and you would have found what you spent, you know, 4 or 5 months or longer working on, and spending $30,000-$40,000 to figure it out, because that's becomes your starting point. You just need something to show somebody so they can comment and give you feedback. I think that's the biggest stumble that a lot of entrepreneurs make.
I think so. And I think part of it too is like, if I think about that example, that's such an interesting example, because it was like Facebook basically. So we have a two-sided market. We've got the users who are basically, you know, pregnant women, and then the advertisers, right? And as I think back to why I approached that, I was really focused on the advertisers. That, I mean, I understood advertisers. I had experience in ad tech, and I didn't understand pregnant women, obviously, because I'm not a woman and I'm not pregnant. So it was tough for me, even when I got feedback, you know. So I put together what I thought they would be interested in and what I thought would be of value to them. It turns out I was totally wrong. But even when I got feedback from them that I was totally wrong, it was really hard for me to figure out, well, what should it have been? Like, what feature should we add? Like, it was a struggle for me because I'm not a pregnant woman. It was really hard for me to put myself in their shoes. Like, you know, we could go on a long time about like understanding women. That's an entirely different podcast. But, you know, so I think that was a problem. So I think in hindsight, like if you approach something like that, I needed a woman on the team, like a pregnant woman, ideally on the team, to help me design that part of the business. And I didn't have that. So it was a huge gap.
And I think another thing that's also important is that when you're creating it, I think this is the biggest challenge all entrepreneurs face, including us, even for this show, is you got to be okay with creating a kind of a crappy first product. And that's fine. I mean, all you want to do is put a stake in the ground. It just sits in your head otherwise, but you have to at least get a toothpick out there, because that toothpick will allow you to build some kind of foundation around it.
Yeah.
And so you just, you got to be okay with not putting a shitty product out there just to get feedback.
Well, what's helpful in that is like when you go through the MVP process and you have to define your features. And then if you're a dev doing it yourself, it's worthwhile to scope out like how much time you think these features are going to take to build. Or if you're hiring someone, it's more direct. Like you can put a dollar amount on each of those features. And then you look at the whole thing and you realize like what you scoped, what you thought was the minimum, is going to cost you like $200,000 to build.
Right.
And then you realize like, well, that's a lot of money. How can we break this down? And you start like peeling it back. Okay, so how could you cut that in half? And then how could you cut that in half? And you start getting down to some really tough choices about what is really the minimum feature set that you need in the first version.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that discipline is helpful. But it's tough. It's tough to figure that out sometimes.
So as we're making parallels between, you know, some of these questions that we're posing to each other here with regards to how do you get something off the ground, let's kind of come up with, you know, what was our process when we were having a discussion a week ago about, maybe we should do a podcast because we,
can I pause for a second? Cause I don't think I gave you the second biggest mistake.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Please.
I think I said there were two, right? Just real quick. The first mistake on, you know, building MVPs too fast. The second mistake, I would say, if I could just throw this out there, is self-doubt. Self-doubt, I think, is the biggest mistake.
Yeah.
Biggest mistake. And it's something everybody struggles with because you have this idea and you think it's going to be a good idea, but you don't really know. And so you just doubt yourself. And if you have any kind of setback, like you might talk to one customer and that customer doesn't resonate with them, you'd be like, oh, I guess this was a horrible idea. Well, that's not necessarily true. That just means that one customer didn't
exactly. So, and you do have to, you have to have some guts in order to do it. I mean, you are putting yourself out there. You're going to your network and to some strangers, and you're actually saying, this is an idea I have. I would love to have your opinion on it. It takes a little bit of guts, and you got to get out of your comfort zone in order to do that.
Yeah, and I think it's guts for sure, but it's more, I want to pick up on what you said before where that example you used, the guy was like, if we don't get funding in 3 months, you know, I'm going to go back to my job. Here's what I learned about like creating something. Like you can't have that condition. If you put that condition out there, you're going to fail because it's almost like if your attitude is I need to see it in order to believe it, it'll never manifest.
I agree.
You have to do it in the reverse order. You have to believe it. And then once you believe it, you will see it. And that's what people don't kind of realize because they don't realize that they can create these things. Like you're part of the equation. Like the fact that you are inspired by this, you are the creator. Like most people think, you know, the universe is happening to them and different things are happening to them, but no, they're creating it. So in order to create something, you have to believe it first. And then let it unfold. And so when you don't do that, you have doubt. All this doubt creeps in and then the doubt just becomes self-defeating and then it's over.
Amen. Amen. I mean, look at as many times as we've started stuff. I mean, the things that have hit the trash can, the trash can really are sometimes those things where I defeated them, not necessarily because they were bad ideas. I mean, in my head, I was like, I can't do it. And that's one of the reasons why, even when we were talking about our podcast here and the concept, my goal when we talked about it last week was let's just do one podcast because that's manageable for me. That is something I can say, okay, we will assess where we go after we create this one podcast. But if I were to overthink this and say, what could this podcast become and start thinking about, you know, how are we going to market this? Or all of a sudden I would have been completely frozen and I would have been like, I don't know where to go. And I would have just put this to bed. But I think that my approach, because this is based on years of experience with me is, hey, just keep it simple and just look at it and say, hey, I'm going to do the first step here. Yeah. In this case, it's, I'm going to create a podcast within the first week. And let's just see where it goes. We may decide never to do it again. I'm not overthinking it. I don't want to think about what this is going to become. It's going to become something naturally if I enjoy doing it.
Yes.
But I think the whole thing was to keep it really simple and focused and stay in the present. And I know it, even with myself, I will creep out a little bit and I'll be like, well, where can it go? I said, nope, the focus is on this one episode. And we're going to figure out how to do it. And I'm just going to put it out and hopefully we can get it done within, you know, 8 to 10 days. And that's it.
I think that's really, really smart. I mean, I think, you know, it's a really good example because you don't have to figure out the how right away. Like it's actually really hard to figure out the how. I mean, you might answer that question how, and you have a bunch of hypotheses on how this business, but most of those are going to be wrong. So it's not even worth it at the beginning to try to figure out the how necessarily. So I think what you're doing is just really, really smart. Just take one like simple baby step, learn from it, and then take the next logical step. Let it kind of unfold in a natural way without being forced in a certain direction. And it's also, it's just a lot more fun that way too.
Because, absolutely. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I always come back to, you know, and I remember this scenario. Must have been in fourth grade or something like that. And one of my friends got a video recorder and he came out and he said, "Hey, I shot a little bit of a film the other day." And we looked at it and it wasn't very good at all, but we were like, "Ooh, that's really cool. Can you show me how to do it?" And so he said, "Yeah." And we decided we were going to shoot something that day. And we had a bunch of friends that were playing in kind of the playground. And so we went over to him and said, "Hey, let's create this movie." And we just on the fly came up with some kind of theme. And then everybody took a character that they wanted to play and we ad-libbed it and we shot the thing. And so from the time that we decided that we were going to do something until the time we actually shot this film, which was horrible, by the way, but it was fun, was literally an afternoon. And then we did a little bit of editing on it. Not much, because we didn't know how to edit. We were just playing around with it and it was funny and we laughed, but we did it for the fun of it. We did it because we had some time to kill, for one. Two, we were doing stuff with our friends, so that made it fun. And we were just naturally saying, "Hey, this looks interesting. I think I'm gonna try it out." And I think that's the approach that I'm trying to take as I've gotten a little bit older and more experienced. And even with this podcast, is this sounds interesting. I like Dave. We have these great conversations anyway. Let's just try to put something together that's just fun.
Yeah. So let me go back to the question. I'm sorry, I diverted off your question. What was the question you're asking? Like how we came up with this idea? Was that it?
Yeah. So it was just a little bit of a discussion of how we came up with this idea and what we did this past week to kind of just prepare for this first episode.
Yeah. I mean, I think to me, the nugget, the idea was like, we've just had great conversations. And I remember getting off of a couple of those long conversations with you that were very similar to this one. I was like, "Man, we should record that. That was some good stuff that came out of that."
I agree.
You know, so I think it's that co-creative, like I couldn't have that conversation just with myself. Like you and I are doing it and we're creating this thing together and bouncing off of each other. And it's just like a beautiful thing. And I think we're so aligned. I use that corporate world, but, you know, vibrationally aligned because we've had similar experiences. I think anyone who has tried to create a business from scratch, there's just a common set of experiences there of ups and downs that create this immediate connection, you know? And I see this all the time. Like if I meet somebody who's an entrepreneur, generally the meeting goes great. If I meet somebody who's like a corporate person and has never created anything, it's like, doesn't go as great. It's just something to do with like common interests and common experiences that you can draw from, what kind of forms how you think about things. And so, yeah, I mean, to me, that was part of it. And then the other part of it is I just, you know, I love teaching. I love mentoring entrepreneurs. And I've thought about, you know, ways to find more entrepreneurs that I can help. And, you know, it seems like using YouTube and podcasts might be a way to do that. So there's a little bit of an idea there, but mostly I just like talking about entrepreneurship and startups and just think it's fun and maybe somebody would enjoy listening to it.
Absolutely. And I think since we kind of proposed the concept, I think it was about 8 days ago, you know, I was like, the first thing I did was I kind of looked and I said, well, what does it take to put a podcast out there? And I kind of looked at all the different things that I needed. And I was like, it looks like I just need to buy a mic. Apparently sounds important to this.
So. Yeah, you know what's funny about this? Cause I left you a couple messages. I had been, I was talking to the friend of mine who owns the ThinkSpace, his co-working space in Seattle. And he bought a bunch of podcast equipment, like with video. He was going to do YouTube stuff. And I reconnect with him and we started to throw around some ideas around creating a YouTube channel or doing a podcast. And I was starting to get excited about it. So I had this kind of in my mind and in my vibration. And then And then I thought about you again. I was like, you know, it would be perfect guy to do this with is Paul Benovich. Like, and then, so I called you and I didn't hear back from you right away. And I was like, I don't know what Paul's doing. I think he's working on some project. But then, you know, like, it was funny because as I was thinking about that, you were thinking about it as well, even though we hadn't talked. Right.
Right.
Yeah. And then, so a lot of this is just, you know, divine timing, right? Of like, oh, okay. Yeah. You're interested in that. You're thinking about it. I'm thinking about it too. So we connected and it's like, all right, let's take a shot at it and see where it goes.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, all I did was this, I did some research on it. I got a mic. I figured out how to put the mic up. And then I was like, okay, how are we going to do this when we're remote? So I just did a little research. I saw that you could get a platform called Zencastr and easily be able to record the sounds locally as opposed to having one person record remotely. And that was it. And played around with, looked at some YouTube videos on GarageBand and how to do some editing. And that was it. I felt like at least comfortable enough to do our first recording. And now I've obviously the next steps is trying to figure out how to put it together and put it out there. But that's what I'll tackle this week.
Yeah. Well, we could just give a free shout out to Zencastr. Just, we should probably say they're not a sponsor or anything, but
we have no sponsors right now. In fact, it's just Dave and me.
No sponsors. We have no revenue. This is the first one. But that's cool. I mean, obviously a lot of people are, and this is what's so great about it. I mean, a lot of people are doing podcasts and then there are tools that make it easier. And it's just awesome to tap into that and see like, oh yeah, this is not that hard to do. And what I think sets it apart is the content itself and, you know, your unique contribution to that.
So let me just pose my last question to you. And this is kind of an interesting discussion. We don't have to necessarily have the answer to this. So we're kind of completing our first podcast. And that was my goal, is to get a first, you know, at least do the recording. And now, you know, obviously there's some post-production. But, you know, based on our conversation today, what are some of your thoughts about where we go? Where do we take this? What's our next, if we were to do a next episode, what would that look like?
I think there's kind of two ways we could do it. One is we could just list out maybe a couple other topics. You know, you've got a great outline that you put together for this one. We could just talk about another one, maybe go through a specific example or, I don't know, whatever topics you want to cover that you think are going to resonate. We could do that and maybe map out like three or four. That'd be one approach. The other approach is we could just take this recording and send it to some people that we know who are entrepreneurs and get some feedback.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Also, I'm trying to think too, and just in terms of you know, next steps. Obviously, this last question here is, you know, where are we going to take this from here? Because again, I'm trying to always stay in the present, not think too long. So what would a second episode look like? And because we really haven't found our footing with regards to our theme within the theme. We know that it's entrepreneurship, but the theme within the theme. And we're trying to figure that out. And I thought it might be interesting. My guess is that you and I will have a couple quick discussions, not very long, throughout the week to just kind of give an update and to kind of think about what the next topic might be. It might be interesting to just quickly record those conversations and put them as an addendum to this, just so that people can kind of track, see what happens behind the scenes. So that's just a thought that I had. It's not something we necessarily might do, but it's just something to think about.
Yeah. I mean, I have a couple ideas in that area. I mean, one idea might be we could take like an example project that I'm working on right now and just spend the whole podcast talking about it. And to me, what's interesting is as an entrepreneur, what's interesting is the real life story about how you build a startup. I think there's a lot of a lot of content in the space that's focused on funding and fundraising and getting into the whole venture, you know, venture capitalist, vulture capitalist, venture porn space, you know, like, but to me, it's like, what's missing is as a practitioner, like, how do you do it? And So I like to, I think in that, if that's our goal, or if that could be one of our goals, like going through an example, I think is helpful. That's one approach. And I've got enough, you know, we both have a lot of content on different startups that we've done. We can kind of tell the story. I also have ones that I'm working on right now, which kind of make it pretty real. That's one direction. The other direction.
By the way, I really like that. I like the whole idea. I think one thing that's missing in the space is kind of having some real life case studies where you're documenting the process of going through a startup. And I think you always, because that's where you have this, it's gritty and it's real. I mean, once you've accomplished something and you've had some success and you look back a couple of years, you can't really remember all the competing ideas and agendas and the conflicts that you were having along the way. I think what's really exciting is to be able to document the thought process as you're going through it and all the conflicting ideas that you have to deal with on a daily basis. And I think that's very interesting.
I think so too, because it's really real. I mean, I don't think you ever hear that. I mean, the one, there's a guy out there, you probably know him or people listening know him, Jason Calcanis. He has a heavy influence on me in this context because he's got a really successful podcast and channel called This Week in Startups. And, you know, he's a really successful angel investor now. And he hadn't really been an angel investor, you know, 10 years ago. So people know him. And, he does a lot of interviews. That's kind of his format, is he interviews successful entrepreneurs, right? And so they have to have achieved a certain level of success. Mm-hmm. And so it's like a successful entrepreneur sitting there talking about how massively successful he is. And I think that's interesting, but what you never hear is like the real story about all the shit that failed. Like, The one example that kind of comes to mind is when LinkedIn went public, you know, it was obviously very successful IPO and everybody's like, oh, LinkedIn is so great. There was an interview I read. I don't remember who did the interview, but Reid Hoffman. It actually took him 22 years from the time that he had the idea to the IPO.
Yeah.
22 years. And part of that story involved trying it, failing. He totally failed, huge failure, had to get a job, went back to work at Apple as an engineer, couldn't let this idea go, like kept working on it, kept like tinkering with it while he was employed, eventually figured out like how to get it together again, took another shot at it. And there may have been like two or three like failures along the way. Like, but he just kept coming at it from different angles and eventually got it to the point where it became something. So that's a story. That's a real story. I don't think it's that unrealistic. I think it's pretty common, it's not a story that anyone wants to hear. It's like, well, I gotta work on this thing for 22 years. Like, that's a big commitment.
Well, exactly. Well, that, again, you go back to how do you know if you're an entrepreneur? You work on something for 22 years.
Right? Yeah. You know, there's an interesting quote I heard from someone who's got like 6 black belts in martial arts and happens to be female. And she said, a black belt is just a white belt that refused to give up.
Ah, beautiful. I love it. I love it. I love it. Well, with that note, maybe that's a good ending to this, because that was a great little quote right there.
Oh, okay. Good. Yeah, put that right at the beginning.
Exactly. All right, Dave, I appreciate your time. And
let me just give credit to the person. Elizabeth Wilcox is her name. So let me just throw that in there. She's the one that says that.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Elizabeth. All right. Have a great day, guys.
Okay. All right. See you, Paul. Bye.